All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you all. Be seated, please. Good morning. Welcome to the second hearing for April 9, 2026 for the Idaho Supreme Court sitting in the new Nesperce County Courthouse. As I stated in the prior hearing, very happy to be here and to experience just beauty and efficacy, if that's a good word, of this building. It's great. We appreciate the welcome we received. The case now before us is entitled Needham versus Needham. Shane Needham is appealing and is represented by Craig Smichael.
Smichael, yeah.
And assisted by C. Tom Arkush, who appears only in this matter. The respondent, Janet Needham, is represented by Scott M. Little.
Good morning.
Counsel, do either of you have anything preliminary to argument you need to address?
No, Your Honor.
No, Your Honor.
Very well. Mr. Smichael, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I approach.
Yes.
All right. May it please the court. My name is Craig Smichael. I represent the appellant Shane Needham. I'd like to reserve 10 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Your Honors, this appeal is controlled by two well-established legal principles. First, courts do not possess the robing power to rewrite contracts. And second, courts are under the obligation to fully disentangle the parties to a divorce. Here, the magistrate court failed to follow both principles when it chose to divide the Altura's shares evenly, making both Shane and Janet co-equal shareholders in a closely held corporation. Unlike what respondent contends, this appeal is not an attempt to rehash the trial in this matter, nor second-guess the lower court's decision. Instead, this appeal concerns how the lower courts abuse their discretion by, one, failing to act within the outer bounds of their discretion, and by failing to act consistently with legal standards applicable to them and reach their decisions by an exercise of reason. To demonstrate how the lower courts abuse their discretion, I'll discuss three key points. First, the magistrate court abused its discretion by ordering Shane to sign waivers and effectively rewrite the buy-sell agreement. Second, the magistrate court abused its discretion by failing to completely disentangle the parties. And finally, the magistrate court abused its discretion by failing to value the shares to the day of divorce. Regarding my first point, the magistrate court abused its discretion by ordering Shane to sign the waivers. Before Shane and Janet divorced, the parties signed a buy-sell agreement regarding the transfer of the Altura's shares.
Before you go down this road, I want to talk about facts just to make sure that I understand the record precisely. Would you please tell me who the three directors are of the corporation?
The three directors of the corporation are, or the shareholders, Your Honor?
Directors.
To my knowledge, Mike, Robin, and then I am unsure of the third director at this time.
So, Mr. Needham is not a director?
Currently, no, that is incorrect. He's currently not a director at this time. He sits as a shareholder, though, the majority shareholder between the parties.
Corporation, if I understand the record correctly, is there are three director positions?
Correct, Your Honor. I'm unsure of who is the third shareholder at this time. Let me correct my statement. It is Mr. Needham. Sorry, I was confusing the shareholders and directors at that point as well.
So I'm going to say it one more time. Who are the three? Who are the three directors of this corporation?
Mike, Robin, and Mr. Needham.
Okay. And then who are the shareholders presently?
Presently, it is Shane Needham, who is the majority shareholder, and then Mike and Robin, which are minority shareholders at this time.
Okay, and Shane holds 70,000 shares, and Mike and Robin each hold 35,000.
35,000, respectively, Your Honor.
Okay, and for shareholder meeting purposes, the shareholders vote their shares, correct?
Correct.
Okay, for the director meetings, how do they vote? Does the record tell us?
That is, I am unclear. I'm not sure how to answer that question, Your Honor. I don't have an answer at this time.
Okay.
And Just again, so the record's clear, is there any dispute whether this is a closely held corporation?
There's no dispute whether it's a closely held corporation. This buy-sell agreement included Alteryx's obligation to purchase the shares at book value before a transfer. The buy-sell agreement was a clear and ambiguous contract to which this court exercises review. Neither the magistrate court nor the district court made this determination prior to entering its order regarding the waivers. Instead, the closest determination either court made regarding the buy-sell agreement was that Janet was not a party to the buy-sell agreement, as reflected in the record on pages 233 to 34, footnote 1. The lower court's failure to make this determination alone nullifies its order, as it did not determine whether it was a clear and ambiguous contract and whether it was enforceable. This is established in Dorsey v. Dorsey, 172, Idaho 667. Regardless of whether Janet was a party to the buy-sell agreement or not, she was bound by the terms of the buy-sell agreement. This is well established in the case of Tolley v. THI Corporation, 140 Idaho, 253. There, prior to his divorce, the husband signed a stock purchase and redemption agreement with his corporation. In that agreement, they agreed that the corporation had the obligation to purchase the shares at a certain price in the event of involuntary transfer, such as divorce. The wife subsequently signed a consent to the agreement, binding her to the terms of the SPRA. During their divorce, the parties entered into a property settlement agreement where the wife was to receive the value of the husband's shares as part of her community interests. The wife subsequently attempted to sue the corporation for breach of contract, in which the breach of contract claims were dismissed. This court held that although the wife was not a party to the SBRA, she was bound by the terms of the SBRA due to her signing the consent. Here, Janet signed the BSA and specifically acknowledged and agreed to be bound by the terms of the BSA, as reflected in the record on page 62. As Janet was bound by the terms of the BSA, BSA served as an enforceable postnuptial agreement under Idaho Code 32916. As both in Shane and Janet recognized Alteryx's obligations under the buy-sell agreement that would affect their community property interests in the event of an involuntary transfer, such as divorce.
But I don't understand. I understand the concept that the buy-sell agreement gives the corporation the right and the obligation to buy the shares in the event of either a voluntary or involuntary transfer. I understand that. But point me to the language in that agreement that indicates that this agreement does anything with respect to the valuation of the shares as between Mr. and Mrs. Needham.
I don't have the exact cite to the specific language within the agreement, Your Honor, but there is a clause within the agreement that says that the shares, if in the event of an involuntary transfer, the shares must be purchased back at book value regarding that.
But why does that say anything about what the shares are valued at in the event of these two people divorcing?
Due to the involuntary transfer of what would happen, such as an event of divorce, would be then at the time, under the BSA, at the time that the divorce occurred or the involuntary transfer occurred, that would control the book value of the shares at that time.
Right, but the book value may not compensate her fully for her community interest. It probably doesn't.
That may be correct, Your Honor. In that event, I think that the book value would control part of that reflection of the community interest, and then subsequently the equalization would happen as well at that point. Unfortunately, the magistrate court in this matter made neither finding regarding that and didn't allocate a value to those shares in its decision.
Sorry, did you finish your thought?
Yes.
Okay. Do we have any evidence in the record whether the corporation was in a position to buy back the shares at the book value within a year?
I don't have the specific site in the record regarding that, but I do know that the record reflects that Alteryx at that time was what was considered to be a thriving business with the ability to pay out dividends each year to all this annually to its shareholders. accounting for over $1 million of shares. I also know that both parties did present expert witness testimony regarding the value of Alturas at that time to reflect that they were in a position to purchase that book value.
So you're assuming the value of Alturas indicated an ability to purchase? Or was there actual testimony that, yes, they have the assets or the ability to obtain the money to purchase back her shares at book value?
To my knowledge, there was no testimony regarding that specific question.
And do we know, does the record indicate what the difference was between the book value and the community interest? I mean, I'm assuming we're talking about a difference between, you know, the valuation offered by the experts if Mr. Needham were to purchase back versus book value. Do we have any evidence in the record about what book value was?
The book value versus the community interest number there. Not to my knowledge, Your Honor, and that would be due to the magistrate court didn't actually apply a value to the community interest at that point. So she didn't value the shares as of the day of divorce, nor any value, because she chose to alternately split the shares.
And I understand that. Was there any evidence offered what the book value would have been had the transfer provision been triggered and the corporation had to buy back the shares? Was there any evidence about what they would need to pay?
To my knowledge, no, Your Honor.
So specifically referring to this buy-sell agreement, in looking at it, it appears to be pretty garden variety in the sense that it's doing what most buy-sell agreements do, and that is protecting the survivability of the underlying entity, not necessarily protecting the individual shareholders or owners in their own particular life changes. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that, Your Honor.
I mean, in other words, there's nothing worded in here that doesn't look like, I don't say it's all boilerplate, but it's pretty standard agreement to basically ensure survivability, continuity of the underlying business.
Correct, Your Honor.
Without consideration to marital issues or debt, it provides for those, but it's not trying to provide a unique benefit to anyone in those situations.
Correct, Your Honor. As Janet was bound by the terms of the buy-sell agreement, the magistrate court effectively rewrote the buy-sell agreement by ordering Shane to sign the waivers, which were created and signed by an entity, being Alturas, that is not a party to this action.
And this is where I think for me, Justice Brody's questions about the directors gets to what I'm interested in on this point, which is even though we have the buy-sell agreement and it's for the benefit of a closely held corporation, can't the corporation decide to waive its right to enforce it? And so I'm wondering, when you have two of three directors signing the waiver, is that enough? And do we have in the record any evidence that would tell us if that was enough for the corporation to act to say, we're going to waive our right to enforce this?
I would say no, Your Honor, due to the contract as it's stated. Also, I know that in the record it's reflected that Alturas did also amend its operating agreements as well that included the same language, similar if not the same language as to what the buy-sell agreement was. The right to waive it, I think, may hold into the hand of the entity, but the issue that we see in this is that this entity also was not a party to this divorce action at this time.
Right, but when you're talking about the magistrate court rewrote the contract, I understand the argument, but I'm jumping ahead to having two of three directors saying, we're fine waiving this. Was that enough that the corporation had already said, we're not going to enforce it, and so whatever the magistrate court did here didn't actually cause any harm? Because the corporation had already done enough on its own through the two directors to waive it.
At that time, Your Honor, I don't believe the corporation did enough to actually effectively waive this at this time.
And so are you saying the corporation had to act through all three in order to waive it?
Yes, Your Honor.
And where would I find that in the evidence to support that conclusion in the record?
It would be within the operating agreement of Alturas, which I don't have the specific site for the operating agreement, but I know that was entered into evidence.
And you said they amended it.
They amended it. I think it was subsequent to when the parties first filed for divorce.
Okay.
The buy-sell agreement serves as a last shareholder standing contract, requiring Alturas to buy back the shares in the event of involuntary transfer. The execution of the waivers adds another shareholder that was not originally anticipated nor contemplated when the buy-sell agreement was executed. The magistrate court abuses discretion by failing to act within the bounds of its discretion and by failing to apply well-established legal standards. This court has consistently held that courts do not possess the roving power to rewrite contracts in order to make them more equitable. This legal principle has been consistently applied across the board in many cases, and not just in breach of contract claims, as respondent contends. For example, in Howard v. Perry, this court applied that principle to the dissolution of a law firm. There, this court held that the firm's operating agreement was clear and unambiguous and controlling. It controlled the distribution of assets amongst the members of the firm during dissolution.
The court itself rewriting the contract if the parties themselves voluntarily agreed to waive the rights?
I believe so, Your Honor, because the court is considering an action by the outside party, and it's substituting the contract itself being the BSA for what it deems to be in the best interests of the parties itself.
Your argument, I think, would be much stronger if the parties were being ordered to do this against their will, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
But I understand that's not completely true in this case.
Well, Mr. Needham is being forced to do this against his will at this point, and he is a majority shareholder for Alturas.
But the people that would be adversely affected by it have assented, correct?
Can you repeat your question, Your Honor?
The remaining parties that might be adversely affected by that act have assented. Is that not correct?
That's incorrect to a degree, as part of Alturas, which is in Partis' action, may be affected, but the other affected party would be Janet Needham, who hasn't been forced or ordered to sign anything as well.
So I'm just wondering, are there any actual dissenting parties other than your client?
I think at this time, Your Honor, that would call for speculation as to, based off the record, there may not be at that time, but based off of knowledge, there could be dissenting parties.
I understand you're an advocate, so I'll invite you to speculate a little bit. Are you aware of any dissenting parties other than your client?
Currently, Your Honor, we've received some information that there might be some dissenting parties within Alturas, and that this situation is more difficult than what's being presented or what was presented at the time.
Is there anything in the record we could tie that to?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Well, can I
please
go back to my answer on that and rephrase it? Is that there is some evidence in the record regarding that, specifically regarding communications between Mike and Robin regarding Ms. Needham becoming a shareholder for Alturas.
Expand that a little bit. What are you saying about those communications? What did they reveal?
So there are some text message communications between Mike and Robin regarding Ms. Needham becoming a shareholder for Alturas. Basically, to summarize and paraphrase, that she lacks the knowledge and background to be an effective shareholder because she's nothing more than a housewife. There was communications regarding potential buyout of her immediately, or to remove Mr. Needham from the, or how they can remove Mr. Needham from his position using Miss Janet as essentially what I would say is a pawn in a chess game at this point, as well as just some informal discussions regarding Miss Needham as well. And I don't have the direct record site on that, but it is reflected. It was presented at trial in this matter as well. And so to my second point, the magistrate court abuses discretion by failing to completely disentangle the parties. By rewriting the buy-sell agreement, Master Court further entangled the parties instead of disentangling them. As this court has stated in Lamb v. Preston, courts have a duty to make an equitable distribution of the party's community property in order to disentangle the party's legal affairs. It is not denied that the Master Court in this matter provided a lengthy analysis of both Josephson and Lamb, recognizing the bounds of its authority, but the Master Court failed to exercise reason by trying to factually compare apples to oranges and failed to adhere to the overarching legal principle in both matters. Lamb expanded Josephson's holding, although the two cases were not factually identical. Although those cases were not factually identical, this court in Lamb honed in on important similarities that are akin to this matter. For example, by offering Janet, just like Leslie and Lamb, an interest in Alturas with limited control and marketability, it, quote, does not necessarily offer her a simple monetary value or investment in the business's success. Second, even if Janet were to remain a silent partner in Alturas, like Leslie and Lamb, she would still be entangled in Shane's business affairs. As this court noted, co-ownership by divorced parties could lead to additional litigation and disputes over a variety of issues, such as fiduciary duties, Leslie's rights as a minority shareholder to participate in meetings or make financial inquiries, ownership changes going forward, and the rights of either, in this matter, Shane or Janet to sell their shares and so on. These important similarities from these cases, this court considered in Lamb are directly akin to this matter. Master Court failed to exercise reason in its decision by relying on conjecture that Alturas would continue to thrive and be a well-established business and ignoring the legal principles established in Lamb.
So go ahead.
So I think an important difference between Josephson and Lamb in this case is the ability to pay the valuation of the community interest. In the other two cases, I didn't see anything that suggested there was any question that the spouse could pay the other spouse. Here, a significant part of the magistrate court's considerations were, is the value of Janet's interest going to deteriorate because of the deadlock at the corporate level and other factors, namely your client owing a big attorney fee judgment to the corporation, running a competing business, you know, not being able to agree on how to run the business. So the magistrate court expressed concerns with, is her value going to deteriorate if we require him to pay her out? I think the magistrate court, in connection with that, also expressed concerns that the plan to pay her out was 6 to 9 years of paying her dividends. And so if the value of the corporation deteriorates, dividends are going to deteriorate, she's not going to get paid. I didn't see either of those as considerations in the other two cases. So help me understand why those either weren't reasonable considerations to take into account when making a decision how to resolve this issue of the shares or how do those change the analysis?
The ability, I think in Josephson and Lamb, first and foremost, I don't have the actual record in those two cases, so I don't know what was presented in there. But the ability for Mr. Needham to pay is something that, considering all in all, I think was, frankly, under-considered by the court. For example, is that since this court has entered this order, or not this court, the Master Court entered its order and this matter has been on appeal, Mr. Needham has continued to pay Miss Needham continually the value, the 50% interest in her dividend, that she is owed as her dividends, which to my understanding goes well over $1 million in everything. And so he has continued to pay that. I think as the Magistrate Court noted is that he does have a, I guess you could say, competing business, that is also doing very well, that Mr. Needham has that ability to pay that as well and continue to pay her through a buyout program. I know that in other cases, I believe even in Lamb, that there was a payment program established so that they can continue to pay in that matter.
I think it was 6 months.
Six months,
yeah,
okay.
As opposed to 6 to 9 years.
And I think you know, that was the proposed, that was what was proposed at trial was 6 to 9 years. I think the magistrate court also had discretion to also consider a shorter time period to pay, and it does provide Ms. Needham other recourse to ensure that Mr. Needham pays as well, instead of being tied in now as a closely held corporation as now partners with co-equal playing ground within that corporation.
Right, but where we review this for an abuse of discretion and the magistrate court explained these are other things, factors, I'm taking into consideration in determining the appropriate way to divide the interest in these shares, how was the magistrate court's taking those other factors into consideration, maintaining the value of her interest and ensuring she gets paid? How did the magistrate court err in its decision taking those factors into account?
Sorry, Your Honor. I believe the magistrate court erred because, frankly, it considered much of what Alturas, who's a not part of this action, what was going on with Alturas, and almost treated them as a party in this action in the considerations. I think the magistrate court's considerations more aligns with the problem that happened in Cantor v. Cantor, where the district court started looking at the overall picture of everything and then started substituting what the contractual obligations were to what it deemed as the best interest of the parties, not only for Shane and Janet, but for Alturas as well in that matter. I think it also goes back to, which would have been my third argument, that the community ends at the date of divorce, which I was going to point out that in the matter of Brinkmeyer, was that I think one of the considerations that happened there was that the master court applied the valuation date to the retirement accounts as of the day of divorce to prevent the parties from further manipulating the valuation of what those accounts were going to be, because the court saw that if the parties just kept going and going and going and basically retaining this growth in the value of everything, then the parties could manipulate it. And I think that the magistrate court's consideration regarding how it abused its discretion is clearly that it considered, oh, how does Janet maximize the value of the shares, which is a fair consideration, but that's also under the conjecture that Alturas will always thrive. And so the opposite could be said, that if the magistrate court had that as a major consideration, then say if Alturas fell apart tomorrow, all of a sudden we'd be in a different argument here, in that now it would be that, hey, Janet would want the valuation date to be the date of divorce, because all of a sudden her shares fall under that. And so that is where I see it as the magistrate court failing to abuse its discretion by, one, not following the legal principles it had at hand, but also failing to exercise reason in its matter. And I see that I've gone well over my 20 minutes, Your Honor, so I will reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Chief Justice, fellow justices, Scott Ludwig here on behalf of Janet, and I'm looking forward to answering a number of those questions that you had. I've been in this case from the beginning, so I'm well aware, attended trial, and can answer a lot of questions here that you might have. And I would just throw out real quick that on the valuation piece, one of the big decisions here, even though she didn't get to the valuation because she didn't have to, was the testimony on book value being so divergent from fair market value of this entity, successful entity in Moscow, Idaho, which was very divergent from enterprise value. Of course, in Idaho, we use fair market value, but as you know, in real life, enterprise value far exceeds fair market value sometimes in companies that are hot in the area of pharmaceuticals, for example, especially post-COVID. I would divert real quick.
Yes. What was the difference?
Okay. It was their interest was a $10 million book value. The fair market value was $30 million, their interest, their half. And enterprise value was $50 million, their half. So you can see that difference. And what the judge didn't get to, but all the experts talked about it for a while, is, of course, the $30 million community interest would have for a one-fourth interest if Janet's interest was bought out by Mr. Needham, would have significant discounts for lack of control and marketability. So those issues never got resolved, but the book value, and that's why these other shareholders, at great expense to them, were willing to do this, is because you'll hear the relationship between them and Mr. Needham was very strained. In fact, he sued them, which is all part of the trial record. So I divert real quick because I have a few minutes, but I've been appointed a dozen times as a binding arbitrator in high net worth cases in Idaho, and I appreciate your recent decision in Miller versus Miller, confirming the arbitration process. It's helped a lot of magistrates, and it's allowed me to be involved in those things. But the one I was involved with that I was just finishing when your decision came out was a high net worth case using Oregon law. And I only divert to that real quick because, as a binding arbitrator, not having to apply Idaho law, Oregon law is you can do whatever is just and fair. That's the standard in Oregon. And I only say that in that we're really no different. This is a court of equity. Our magistrates try to do the best they can to make sure that parties are disentangled. We'll talk about that. But the parties are treated substantially equally and have control of their assets at the time of divorce. And in this situation, Judge Marshall, who knew going into this trial, because both parties have expressed that in their opening arguments, this matter was going to be appealed. Very diverse opinions about what the court should do. So she took great length to make a very good record, as did both attorneys and their parties. And she really studied and differentiated the law, like Josephson and Lamb, that you guys discussed, and what Rohr would allow her to do with regard to ordering someone to execute documents. So she knew going in, and she spent an inordinate amount of time really focusing on this record because it was important in the law in considering her decision. And it really goes to this determination that she was within the bounds of her discretion and she did not abuse that discretion. And it's hard to present any better than Judge Marshall did and Judge Gaskell did on appeal. He took great length also to evaluate Judge Marshall's opinion and go through that, and both of them have about a 20-page opinion and spell it out better than I ever could to you right now because it was right on along the way.
Well, let's talk about Rohr.
Yes.
I don't see anything in Rohr that allows a magistrate judge to force a corporate director and shareholder to sign an agreement that's for the benefit of a closely held corporation and arguably implicates fiduciary duties. I mean, when I read Rohr, Rohr is talking about executing documents to facilitate transfers. And I see this as in an entirely different category where we have a buy-sell agreement, three directors, you know, Ms. Needham has assented to the agreement, agreed to be bound by it, ordering a director and a shareholder to sign an agreement waiving the corporation's right to enforce the buy-sell agreement. I don't see how that falls under Rohr at all. It strikes me as something in a different category entirely.
Well, Rohr covers a wide list of plenary powers that the court would have in a family law matter. And it talks about assignments, deeds, all sorts of things, and Rule 801 and the family law rules cover the same thing. So I'd only respectfully disagree with you that Rohr is right on in allowing a magistrate judge in a divorce case to order a party to do something to effectuate their decision. That, in this case, as you know, the decision was to order that he execute a waiver and consent so that what would be called a divorce clause would be waived, and the court doesn't have jurisdiction, as you know, over the other two shareholders, Robin Wood or Mike Pearson.
And my concern is, does ordering Mr. Needham to do that require him to violate his fiduciary duty to act in the best interest of the closely held corporation? Because it might not. be in the corporation's best interest to take on a fourth shareholder who is a former spouse, former, you know, and insert somebody else into the corporation. That's effectively what requiring Mr. Needham to sign this waiver does. And I don't see anything in Roar that allows the court in exercising those powers to effectuate divisions to violate or force the parties to violate duties or contractual obligations that they owe to others.
So you have two other shareholders that own 35,000 shares each, and then the Needhams have 70,000 shares. And those other two shareholders, to whom the fiduciary duty would be owed, executed that waiver. The other shareholder, Mr. Needham, who shared an equal interest in those shares by virtue of their stipulation in the community property laws, in that particular set of shares, supported the signature. So the fiduciary duty that would be breached, you have all the remaining people involved that would be subject to that fiduciary duty supporting the division of the shares, except for one person who selfishly wouldn't do that to his own benefit because he wanted to get those shares as cheap as possible. And we'll talk about the disentanglement issue in a second. And maybe there's some more factual information that might help in discussing this fiduciary duty about what Mr. Needham did with regard to Alturas along the way. And this was in the trial record. Here's what it was. It's a good segue. If I've answered at least enough of your question right now so I can get to that piece.
So based upon what you just said, I want to make sure I'm clear. I'm understanding. You're saying the only reason it was proper for the courts, district court and magistrate court, to agree this was okay was because there were no dissenters?
There were no dissenters except for Mr. Needham.
Exactly. But if there had been a dissenter, would it be proper?
Potentially, if that's what the court determined to do. By the way, if there's a dissenter and it was one of the other shareholders and they didn't sign that waiver, this is a whole different deal.
Right. I'm just trying to figure out how we're going to write an opinion that would suggest that this is always permissible and overlook the fact that in future cases there might be serious dissenters.
I would agree right on with you, Justice, other than you had everybody supporting this except for Mr. Needham. And the difference is this was the method that I believe the court was authorized to do to effectuate the equal division of the assets, the immediate control of those assets, the equal value of those assets in her determination.
I mean, it's not uncommon in a divorce under our community property laws that the magistrate has authority to order third parties to do things.
Right.
A lot of that's facilitated by statutes, right, like quadros, military retirement benefits, you know, ordering third parties to do things that they wouldn't normally do in the course of their business. This one, though, where we're dealing with private entities, private individuals, private contracts, it would seem to me that unanimity of all of the third party interested in the case might be required.
And that's what you have here. But I would only state that the court doesn't have jurisdiction to order third parties to do something. The court has the full jurisdiction to order that the parties to the litigation. So this court didn't have jurisdiction over Alturas. This court didn't have jurisdiction over Mike Pearson or Robin Woods. This court had jurisdiction over the parties, and in making its decision on what would be the best way to make both parties as whole as possible under the circumstances and disentangle them as best as possible, that one document waiving that divorce clause, she had the authority to execute that. But in this scenario, there aren't any dissenters except for Mr. Needham, who is a party to the litigation and lost at the magistrate level and district court level.
I think it's just, go ahead.
The right and obligation to purchase shares under the buy-sell agreement in this case belongs to Alturas, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And only Alturas.
Right.
And Alturas has to act through its board of directors, correct?
That's true, which in this situation, those waivers, it requires 100% of the shareholders to execute that. And that's what those waivers were for the shareholders to execute.
But the corporation has to execute the waiver. The corporation is the one who has the right to buy those shares,
mm-hmm.
correct?
Correct.
So you need a board of directors approving the waiver, correct?
And we had two of those board of directors sign the waivers.
Did we have this waiver? I mean, was this presented to the board of directors?
Yes. It was. These were prepared by a corporate attorney, presented at the board. In that board meeting, the board of directors approved it, signed it. The shareholders signed it. Mr. Needham was at that board of meeting. And at the trial transcript, you'll find that he secretly recorded that meeting without disclosing to the other board of directors members that he was doing that. That was going to be the behavior I was going to get to when I finished Justice Zahn's question.
Okay. So in this case, Judge Marshall ordering the execution of the waiver, she's not ordering Mr. Needham to sign that document in his capacity as a director, because that's already been exercised
right.
by Pierce and
Woods. So
as a shareholder.
So there is unanimous consent to waive that divorce clause. I call it the divorce clause because that is the effect of it. If the court ordered that the shares be transferred, then they get to buy the shares at book value. Ms. Needham doesn't get treated fairly with Mr. Needham, who's going to get a big windfall by continuing to hold his shares at the true value of the company.
So the magistrate court's order then is only effectuating him in his personal capacity, nothing to do with his corporate.
Correct. Role. Correct. If I could just talk real quickly about some of the behaviors that got to, I think, where Judge Marshall said, you know, this makes most sense to do this. Treats Janet most fair and Mr. Needham most fair. Mr. Needham was fired from his chief science officer or something back in 2000 or so, 2020. This company was a mom and pop. That's the amateur corporate documents in some ways. If this company had been doing $25 million when it started, it certainly would have had probably some real more advanced corporate documents involved, but started in a garage, grew, Mr. Needham's shares and Janet's shares were all in one name, his community property. And then the others had their half of the shares and two certificates. If that hadn't happened, we wouldn't be here today. This would have been real easy because we'll get to the disentanglement piece in a second. But Mr. Needham, his relationship deteriorated, of course, with the other two shareholders. The board's at a complete deadlock. The company can't move forward, and that's probably why the other two shareholders were happy to do this. They may have been taking a significant haircut, but they saw the value in having the ability to have a different makeup of shareholders so they could move this company forward.
I'm not sure. When you say there's a deadlock, and your briefing was very clear, and it was very precise, it said that they're deadlocked at the shareholder level. So, but it seems to me that when you have three directors, Robin and Mike seem to be aligned on everything. Why are they deadlocked?
They can't make certain decisions without full approval of the board.
Which decision?
For example, they want to expand and develop a significant additional facility in Moscow to handle their growing capacity, and part of the board wanted to take debt out, and Mr. Needham deadlocked that, and so they ended up having to use their retained earnings to do that. And for quite some time, no dividends were paid out because of that capital requirement with their dividends. And so at the board level, that was deadlocked on making the decision to give a capital expenditure. The only thing in the trial record you'll see that they ever agree on is distribution of dividends. They can't agree on anything else. On occasion, they might agree on a piece of equipment they buy, but that's clear in the record. Both shareholders testified about not only the relationship, but the obstructions to this company growing with the deadlock that's at the board level. And that deadlock's created by the 50% voted the shares voted by Mr. Needham. Now, it's speculation as to when these shares are divided.
Well, and I guess that's the reason I asked the question out of the gate. How do the votes take place at the board level? I mean, do they vote shares at the board level?
Yes. So.
And I didn't see that in the bylaws that they're voting by share. So where do we find that?
Well, the finding at the trial court level was there was a deadlock, and that was the testimony, and that was Judge Marshall's finding that there's a deadlock on decisions made in this company because of the vitriolic relationship between Mr. Needham and the other two shareholders.
I understand that finding, but I'm just asking for the corporate documents that demonstrate how these decisions are supposed to be made. Because again, I looked at your briefing and it's very precise. Mm-hmm. They're deadlocked at the shareholder level.
Yeah.
And I could see in the bylaws, you know, your shareholder decisions are different, and they require different quorums and different unanimity requirements, et cetera. But I want to know how the director positions function, how the board functions.
Judge Marshall found that there was a deadlock at that level, and that's an issue that was at the trial level. And if it was something different than that was her finding, and there's been no... I don't think any part of the appeal addresses that question that you're raising, Justice Brody, that this company is clearly deadlocked, and the reasons why, because of the relationship between 50% shareholder by name and the other 50% shareholder. So as to how they got there, I was going to describe the behavior, but from a corporate standpoint.
But wait a second, if I may. I think Justice Brody's question is pretty simple if you know the answer. Is the director vote one vote per director, or do they vote based on their percentage of ownership of the company?
No, one vote per director. I'm sorry if I missed that. One vote per director at the board level, but a lot of things are required to have unanimous shareholder support, and that doesn't happen because of the makeup of the shareholder interest on the Needham side.
Got it.
But
so
whether there's a deadlock or not, that was an incidental finding. I'm just discussing that to show the vitriolic relationship
sure.
between the two sets of shareholders there. So I as far as the deadlock, I don't. It is what it is. If the company was operating great, what you will find is that because of the relationship of this, Mr. Needham sued Alturas, lost, John Judge awarded fees for his frivolous proceeding of $200,000. This is in the last 5 years. It was all over board stuff. You guys awarded Ms. Needham fees on a contempt proceeding. That's come to the Supreme Court for frivolous. District Court John Judge awarded fees for this appeal. So we're going to be asking for the fourth time that we get fees for arbitrary and frivolous without foundation appeal here. The continued behavior here that I think is important to touch on, that is that Mr. Needham, and this was found by Judge Marshall, after he was fired, and the vitriolic relationship grew, he went out and he leads a competitor and has stolen several clients of Alturas. And this sort of behavior, of course, probably will result in potentially more litigation. I don't know. But, you know, he just went out. He set up an LLC, so he leads that other company through an LLC he formed to try to insulate. But she found that he was... in leadership of a competitor to Alturas and had stolen several clients. She found one for sure, and she said potentially a second. And this is a guy who sits on the board of this company and has half the shares in his name, even though they have equal ownership of those shares. So these were all some of the things that led to why she thought this would be a good solution within the bounds of her discretion. I want to talk about, you've heard some information about the valuation, but I'd like to talk a little bit about this disentanglement. Judge Marshall found, and Judge Gaskell agreed, that the method of dividing these shares would be the best way to disentangle these people, because what Mr. Needham offered to do was buy out Janet over 4 to 9 years. That's the time period that the judge found. There's no interest rate. There's no collateral. He didn't have the money. And his payment would be on prospective dividends, of which he had no determination of what those dividends would be or not. There was a board, Justice Meyer, board decision there whether dividends get paid out. When they're paid out, it's a 2-to-1 vote that they're paid out. That's one area where he's always voted in support of the other
two. Understandably. It's in their best interest to get paid.
It's up to the other two board members on that. But if no dividends are paid out, let's say that she gets, book value, which would be a terrible result for her based on what he would end up with if this was some different result. But if it was an installment plan, it's the worst underwriting that could possibly happen. You got a guy with nothing who's hoping to get dividends. I'll pay it over time. Could be 4 years, could be 9 years. No interest rate, no collateral. And the judge thought that sort of entanglement would be much worse than just having their own shares, which had equal value. They get an equal stream of dividends, and their only pass would cross at shareholder votes. So
before we go further, we're well into the disentanglement topic now. I've heard disentanglement talked about in different ways by both sides here today, in their briefing, below. I've reviewed 32.712. Is disentanglement an aspirational goal for divorces in Idaho, or is it a legal requirement?
It's not a legal, the word disentanglement, there's times that there's it's not possible. And now in this situation, this is the least possible disentanglement. It really, and it goes back to the Josephson and the other, can't remember the other name, but the two cases, the difference in that were a lot more than what I heard from the bench. It was the party getting shares that would have been in Ms. Needham's situation had no voting rights, no possibility of stream of income if the controlling party who ran the company, which was the other spouse, those cases were well laid out, the differences by both Judge Marshall and Judge Gaskell. This is different. These parties are both going to get their shares now at equal value. And to get back to your question, it's not an absolute. That's the goal. It's an aspirational. But I've handled 5,000 family law cases, and sometimes it's just not possible. And one of those areas is in the dairy farm world down there in Jerome and Wendell. There's never enough liquidity to cash someone out $50 million, and the ag lender won't allow that to happen anyway on the line, so they end up, those cases always end up in a resolution because you have to come to some creative solution. Otherwise, everything gets liquidated at a fire sale. A fair installment can happen on occasion if you have you have to kind of underwrite it, I think. You know, from an equitable standpoint, you have to make sure you're going to get paid, that there's assets to pay you, there's stream of income to pay you, you have collateral. In those dairy farm cases,
suggested in this case?
Pardon me?
Wasn't that some kind of installment suggested at one time in this case?
That was Mr. Needham's approach to buying Janet Needham out in this case is, hey, I'll pay you with 75% of my net dividends. So whatever I get, I'll give you 75%. Maybe it'll take 4 years. Maybe it'll take 9 years. No, I don't know what I'm going to get next year. I don't know what I'm going to get. I don't know if I'm going to get any dividends in the next 3 years. And Judge Marshall said, he may stop paying. He may not get dividends. He may file bankruptcy. There's just so many different things that could happen. He may sue the company again. The company may sue him for the competition issues. She said, to put you in an installment plan over 4 to 9 years, no interest rate discussed, zero collateral, other than the hopeful dividends that may be paid, most likely would be paid, but we don't know, was the most outrageous underwriting that Mr. Needham could possibly ask the court to approve to buy out Janet Needham's share at a significant discount because of the valuation issue.
But doesn't the magistrate court have the authority to include some terms that would take care of that, to add interest, to require payments of a certain amount regardless of the source, to require a term that to the judge would be more reasonable under the circumstances. I mean, the judge didn't have only a choice of going along with Mr. Needham's plan, correct?
Correct. She chose a different plan.
No, no, no. I don't mean between the two things.
Yes.
She could have, the district, or yes. Excuse me, the magistrate court could have inserted other terms.
Absolutely. The judge, Marshall, could have said, I'm going to play underwriter. Let's impute a fair market interest rate. Let's see, as far as third-party payment of this obligation, she didn't have any jurisdiction over a third party to say X, Y, or Z is going to pay you. A term, he couldn't even tell you how he's going to pay it back. How could the judge come up with something that was going to end up in litigation over a breach? Was she going to go 9 years, 4 years? Maybe he needs 15. Let's give him a lot longer time. And that makes Janet Needham, the bank, for a long time with insecure collateral, no collateral. There was zero collateral. So, yes, the answer to your question, Justice, is the judge could have imputed an interest rate, a term, but under these facts that's on the record in front of Judge Marshall, she'd be redoing an entire installment plan. And I don't know how she would have possibly come up with the terms that would have not been speculative.
I mean, but the concern is the opposite extreme. You've got a closely held corporation, and now the court is injecting another shareholder, and arguably, I don't know if she'd be a director, probably not, but injecting another shareholder. And that's my concern, is was there enough inquiry into other available ways to separate this property and get Mrs. Needham paid before we jumped to, I'm going to make you an equal shareholder with everybody else, and I'm going to force Mr. Needham to sign this waiver that waives the corporation's buy-sell agreement.
I'm going to pile on. I can't think of a universe in which a 50% majority owner of a closely held corporation would want to become a 25% owner of a corporation and lose that majority status and lose his status as a director, because he's not going to be a director once these shares get split.
One thing I want to make sure that everybody's aware is these aren't just Shane Needham shares. He's on the certificate, but they're a community asset. And when they stipulated at the time of the divorce, they said their equal community interest is hereby confirmed. All issues with regard to the party's shares are reserved for further determination. Then later in the document, the court shall retain jurisdiction over any issues the parties may have. So taking care of Shane Needham, who has his name on the certificate, but it's a community asset, so that he can have a wild installment arrangement to buy out his wife at a significantly less than fair market price, is not meeting what this judge said. This is what's fair. This is equal. Everybody gets control of their asset. They have equal value. You're both going to get the same stream of dividends over time. And if this asset sells for $100 million, Janet Needham gets her fourth.
Sorry to interrupt, sir, but I believe you're out of time.
12 seconds. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
3 minutes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Cross view. Quick and efficient, Your Honors. Regarding my first point of rebuttal, Your Honor, just to clean up some of the questions that were previously asked. Regarding the payment, the ability for Mr. Needham to pay Ms. Needham the book value or the community interest in there, Mr. Needham at trial did testify that he could pay independently, not relying solely on the dividends received from Alteris at that time.
Over what period of time? Because I tend to agree with Mr. Ludwig, 4 to 9 years, just if I get my dividends, I'll give you 75%. I mean, I can understand why, from Mrs. Needham's perspective, that's not going to work. So over what period of time did he say he could pay?
I believe it was 5 and 9 years is what I understand. But as pointed out earlier by this court, the master court did have the jurisdiction to create a different installment plan if needed regarding that. And Mr. Needham did have the ability to pay independently regarding whichever way the magistrate court would have decided to pay an installment period at that time. And the magistrate court would retain jurisdiction also to enforce that order as well, which I think would better disentangle the parties than making them now co-equal shareholders in a closely held corporation. Regarding the community property interests for both parties and whether that would be fair or not for it being book value according to the buy-sell agreement, the buy-sell agreement itself establishes that it would have been book value is what she would have been paid, what Janet would have been paid. Specifically, Janet agreed to be bound by the terms of the buy-sell agreement, including the book value of the share to receive as recognition of her community property interests.
Well, but your client's position at trial was fair market value, right? Did he take the position that she gets book value? And that's part of the problem I have with the whole argument that she's bound by the terms of the buy-sell agreement, that it somehow determines the value of her share as between her and her husband. Because I didn't, as I read Mr. Needham's testimony, he was saying fair market value.
If it was fair market value, I believe it's just a misconception of the words of fair market versus book value.
The only thing the acceptance says is she agrees to be bound by the terms and conditions. So my understanding would be her shares would be valued, her community property interest would be valued fair market value. Now, Alturas, if the agreement's triggered and not waived, may have to compensate her for book value, but why wouldn't your client owe her the remaining difference?
I believe it just is the terms of the contract to which to follow. And I see my time is running.
Go ahead and answer.
I believe it's just applying the terms of the contract that she agreed to be bound by, which does say book value as recognition of her community interest.
I don't think it says that, but I understand it.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Counsel, thank you very much. Matter is now under advisement. The court now will be recessed until April 15th, 2026.
All rise, please.